of coal, and to understand, notably, the low cost of renewable energy.
One version of the company's plan calls for shutting down 4 units in Wyoming. 2 Jim Bridger units would close in 2025 instead of 2037. Naughton 1 and 2 would retire 4 years ahead of schedule in 2025. Coal industry groups claim the move would tilt the scales in favor of wind and solar operations and lead to further job losses. Anderson says the 20-year plan provides enough notice for state and local governments to help communities reliant on coal to adapt and get workers the training and resources they need to transition to new jobs. Anderson adds that PacifiCorp has a legal obligation to ensure the lowest energy costs possible for its customers.
It's not about providing preference to one kind of energy over another or anything like that. It's really just about saving customers money.
The public can offer additional input in early October at a meeting to be announced by the Wyoming Public Service Commission on its website. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we are online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, September 11th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Janae Boyer. The producer is Claire Rosciato, and our engineer is Althea Billings. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Claire Rosciato.
Good night.
Trauma doing in my head, homicide. Hunt me down and gun me down every time I go outside. Choke the man to death in the light day. Shot that boy in his head and let his body lay. They afraid of me and I'm afraid to live. Aimlessly, courage, faith, and bravery. Let's evade slavery. Punch it down, gun you down. Choking on your blood, you drown. Maybe they will learn when the tables turn. Block the arteries and let the city burn. I have no choice, I have no voice. So I'm taking out the lights. You won't see me coming under cover of the night. They say they felt the internet justifies murder. They get acquitted, I don't forget it in the streets, I'm turner. They insincere and insecure and immature, nervous. Some of us try to organize, we're gonna die a certain. We make them rich hand over fist, the products that we purchase. The food we eat, the thoughts we think, the shit we drink, it hurts us. All our lives we pay the price, I'm going against the current. The system's weak, they face defeat, but that's beneath the surface. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, the whole world's blind and toothless. I want justice and I think there should be retribution. The police are a lynch mob, public executions. They operate above the law, brutal and abusive. Someone reform, what do we want? We want revolution. Freedom and democracy, you suffer that illusion. There will be blood, there will be death, there will be less confusion. Now there's violence daily and apparently we're losing.
Riot is the language of the young and hard. Riot in the flames and the thunder. Titan in the chains that I'm under. Suffering the pain and the hunger. Riot is the language of the young and hard.
Hush me with capital, try me. Trap is my radical, methods are tactical, highly. Talking about clapping niggas, you do them like the Kennedys. Another black man trapping, you know that is not my enemy.
Riot is the language of the young nerd. Riot in the flames and the thunder. Titan in the chains that I'm under. Suffering the pain and the hunger. Riot is the language of the young nerd. Lightning in the flames and the thunder. Titan in the chains.
was shed so long I never respect the system of stress, struggle, victimization, prison and debt. Prolong, put my life on the line, running out of time. They kill us, we take revenge, we kill them. Then they come for our family and friends. Once the cycle begins, it will never end. Until our sides quit the game that no one wins. No one wins, no one wins, no one wins.
I think America must be right. It must develop out of thin air. Conditions continue to exist. Alliance is the language of the unheard.
Hello. How you Hello. Doing, KBOO listeners?
We come from...
We are on the phone live with my man, Ryan Dillard, a.k.a. DJ Stage 1, all the way from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Stage 1, Ryan, what's up, bro?
What's up? What's up?
Hey, I'm glad to be connected with you, man. It's been years since we've seen each other. We've talked a few times, you know, we've connected through hip-hop. I saw you when you were out here touring with the Micronauts. You and I know each other from north side of Minneapolis and then ultimately citywide. But I wanted to talk to you about your book, about the history you have in hip-hop culture, about growing up in a very turbulent but important time in the Midwest, part of the hip-hop underground, and talk about the climate on the streets and all that. Can we get into it, bro?
Let's go.
That's what's up, man. So before we start, let's get started with where are you from, man?
Originally from Dayton, Ohio.
And you when did you move to Minneapolis?
1985.
Okay. And then so we started seeing each other on the streets of Minneapolis in the 80s. I came to know you as somebody that was deeply involved in hip-hop culture. You want to tell the listeners about how you found your way into hip-hop culture, what it meant to you, and what your day-to-day life was looking like at that time?
At the time, I was just a young kid, you know, teenager and preteen around that era. And was always into art, comic books, and stuff like that. So I was, you know, genuinely attracted to graffiti art. And that became my first love, first passion. But music always played the soundtrack along the way, whether it was Marvin Gaye, George Washington, Grover Washington, excuse me, Stanley Turrentine, Duran Duran, Iron Maiden. It just does this mad different soundtracks. And hip-hop played the perfect soundtrack to graffiti art that I was embracing as a kid. And my parents were music lovers and actual singers, which gave me a plethora of just sounds that I was exposed to as a kid, Afro-Cuban music and just all types of different things. So I was exposed to breakbeats early. I would hear songs or DJ mixes that had certain beats or breaks in them that you know, we're in my parents' record collection and whatnot. So I was identifying with hip hop in a different manner. I didn't really come into it as being the B-boy. It was more of a visual and sonic type of thing, which kind of helped me breeze through my teenage years by just having such a vivid imagination and stuff like that.
Okay, man, that's great. I can relate. I remember, you know, seeing that energy on the streets, in the community, you know, and identifying with other young people who were picking up on it. The DJ and the graffiti aspect is how you got down. Did you ever do any other aspects of as far as the elements of hip hop and expressing yourself?
A little bit of b-boying, a little bit, you know, that was just for a second. I think it was more of a trendy thing.
Uh-huh.
Because the music was like, I was more interested in what was coming out of the radio, more so than what somebody was doing on the floor, even though that was fly too. But I was, you know, more into, you know, Grandmaster DST and Grandmaster Flash and you know, different people like that that were really getting down and doing mixes where, you know, to where the dancers were mimicking the beats and breakdowns and stuff to the beat. You know, I just kind of got more drawn sonically to it. But b-boying, I think, and later on, I say rhyming, just playing, because we always would rhyme. Like when we would go out tagging or something, we had a little radio, or we just, you know, freestyle, just having fun, because we was into like KRS-One and Rakim, and even in one of the early documentaries about hip hop, they had Case One and DJ K Slay, who was Dez, used to write Dez. They were freestyling and stuff as they was chilling, and that became kind of the thing. Like every time we would go out, we would flow. To where later on in life, one of my old graffiti writing friends, Sluggo from Atmosphere, put me on a song. He's like, "I know you can rhyme. Stop playing. I'm gonna come get you on this date." Da, da, da. I didn't really think he was gonna come. He came pick me up. For some reason, I did write a rhyme, and I put that rhyme down on the song, and it was on from there.
Man.
And I just kind of was like, wow, I can rhyme too, but that's not really my passion, you know what I mean? Even though I do it for fun constantly, but it's more so just graph and music DJing.
So being involved in hip-hop culture so heavily and as such a big part of your development for so long brings us to the subject of The Bridge Is Over, which is a book that you just finished and release. Is that available to the public?
Yes, it is. You want to purchase a book, contact me at djstageone@gmail.com, djstageone@gmail.com, and we'll get that out to you.
And what is the book about, and why did you call it The Bridge Is Over? Because when I think The Bridge Is Over, I think MC Shan.
Yeah, everybody does. And I like that, though, because it gives me a chance to kind of explain myself. And I feel like, you know, a lot of us, you know, everybody has a coming of age, unless you're just not jumping off the porch and you're staying in the house. But we all come of age in our teen years into, you know, the next phase in our lives with a little bit of knowledge just about our environment at the time and learn how to master that. And the book, The Bridge Is Over, Coming of Age Hip Hop Story, it's not a historical event of what actually happened in Minneapolis. It's more of a situation of me, you know, coming up around a lot of, you know, dope people that did graph, that did civil, you know, practiced civil rights, that rhymed, that knew how to gather people together, some athletes, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it just so happens that I met a lot of dope crews, like IRM crews, one of the first crews out here to get signed, you know what I mean? I was just lucky enough to be around them at certain times during their career. There's some pivotal stories and things like that. But it's a coming of age, you know. I was, when I was young, I was, you know, more reserved and shy or whatever, just, you know, quiet and whatnot. I wasn't really expressing myself as a person until I started to really get off into hip-hop culture as far as using, you know, my pen and my spray can and my black book and just going out here fighting the system and things like that, that just brought a whole thing out of me as a person. I started to socially get aware of things about myself and my atmosphere through the streets and just different things like that through graffiti and hip-hop culture. But it was love because of just the people I was around with respect and where I was trying to go with it, like my craft.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, there was a bridge around the way to, you know, I used to go bomb under, practice under, things like that. And it turned out to be like, you know, some sort of a clubhouse or whatever, where we would, you know, after school, that's where we go. You'll meet at the bridge. We'll be down at the bridge hanging out and stuff like that. And basically, once I got to a certain age, a certain point in life, even as I moved out of the neighborhood, even, but I would come back around. But I got to a point where it was just like, yo, I don't need to come down here anymore. It just kind of faded away.
Mm.
But it represented a certain place of solace, artistically and emotionally, where, you know, I would chill and some of my friends would chill out. That was just the spot.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
So when you, being that I'm, you know, spent a lot of my youth on the north side of Minneapolis as well as the south side, but when I moved to Minneapolis, I lived on the north side. And so for the listeners that aren't familiar with the city and the urban landscape, the north side is a black community and a historically black community. And so when hip hop took hold and took root in Minneapolis, it was a lot of the students and the young people on the north side that first really got involved with the culture in an authentic way. And you mentioned IRM, you know, Immortal Rap Masters, were one of the first groups to actually get some publicity outside of Minneapolis. I think they were signed to KTEL. So when you say the bridge, was the bridge one of those bridges on the north side between Worth Park and North Minneapolis?
Yeah, the Olson Highway Bridge. Okay. It was rebuilt in 85.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? We used to go up there, run around when it was doing construction and all that. But once they finished it, we just used to be under there chilling out. That was just the spot. But yeah, that was it. You know, Northside Bridge. There were a couple of them going up towards north towards the railroad tracks from Theodore Wharf.
Uh-huh.
It was like Theodore Wharf Park and Olson. But as you go up, there were other tracks from other neighborhoods. And Wild Style Crew, which is like Viper and Peyton, EB, and, you know, guys like that, Cypher, Decipher. They all lived around there, so that was their bridge. They used to bomb that bridge up.
Right.
So you go down there, then you see like giant Howard the Duck characters, and you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
those
mm-hmm.
inspiring at the time, because you know the demographic of Minneapolis graffiti at the time was more so like Zorro from Wild Style, where you kind of didn't want to be seen, but then for some reason all the kids at school knew who you was. But we were trying to elude the police the whole while, so we weren't like hitting up visible areas at the time. It was like, you go down to the bridge, you can bomb in the daytime, because back then nobody would come down there.
Right, right.
You know, the cops wouldn't, you know, because nowadays they have, you know, police officers on bikes riding the trails. They got trails down there. It's just totally made over into a whole different animal. But back then it was a little more free on some adolescent, you know, fun kind of stuff, you know.
Indeed. And then I'm remembering you mentioned a couple of different crews, and I want to get into there were two crews that I remember interacting with, and I want to get into the bridge, if we will.
Yes.
Between hip-hop culture, gang culture, and the hardcore punk scene, and a lot of the unity that was created specifically around fighting the neo-Nazis and the fascists in the city in the 80s and into the 90s, you had, I recall King's Posse and Mental Madness Posse. Do you want to talk a little bit about those two formations?
Man, look, I was a member of the King's Posse, which was basically an extension of KGB, which is an extension of DS2, which was Death Squad 2. It went from a graffiti crew into an organization of personal information. We weren't trying to go out here and throw stuff in people's faces. We were living our lives where we lived, but we were still trying to get out of self without too much help from adults prodding us to go anywhere politically. We were kind of finding our way.
Right.
I think all of us had the autobiography of Malcolm X in our back pockets. You know what I mean? Like, pretty much. Like, we all eventually got copies. You know, it used to be passed around. But we believed, we had, like I said, we didn't have a political structure, but we just didn't believe in a lot of things that were going on in the community and how kids that were trying to have fun peacefully doing hip-hop and certain venues and stuff were being treated. And it brings us to the racism thing at hand. It was already prevailing on both sides of town, like especially on the north side. The northeast area across the bridge was like no man's land for black people. And across Lowry, like you can go from Glenwood to Plymouth to Broadway to Lowry. You can't cross Lowry back in those days. So just saying that we were already part of, you know, dealing with these kind of issues where we lived at.
Mm-hmm.
Then we just started hearing about neo-Nazis kicking up dust all over the place. And then we hear about a black single woman with her children being accosted in their own yard. You know, total invasion. Slapped around, beating kids, kicked down, you know, things like that. And it was on the news for a while. And it became a situation where, you know, both Mental Madness and King's Posse came together. I remember you guys extended your hand to us in solidarity to, you know, put a stop to these type of things. And it made the news. It created situations where politicians wanted to have sit-downs and you know, try to iron out issues and different things like that. You know, synagogues were being hit up. I mean, it was just crazy at the time. It was on the news a lot.
Yeah.
And it took the young generation to kind of bypass the so-called laws that were put before us to tell us what we could do to combat this sort of racism. And, you know, we did what we had to do at times. And it didn't, you know, I feel personally that it did more good than anything, because mm-hmm. it explained to the community the difference between just kids that you normally see. Like we look just like the kids in our neighborhood, but we think differently. We're part of something better, and we're not trying to be a part of just random violence. You know, the skins and the crews that you was down with might have looked a certain way if somebody didn't take the time to dialogue and, you know, approach the situation with some sense. But you represented a whole different situation. Non-racial, you know what I'm saying, non-violent, you know, unless, you know, you're bringing it to us. You know, we all have to defend ourselves as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a like-minded situation where we all came together for one goal. And at that time, I mean, we were dealing with so much oppression worldwide. I mean, South Africa still was dealing with apartheid. I mean, it was just a lot of atrocities that was just right there in front of us.
Right.
And the music we listened to and our youthfulism at the same time mixed together was just like, we're not going to take this.
Right.
You know what I mean? And, you know, when you're in a community where you are already being counted out, not just for being black or a minority, but for being different, you know, or whatever, not part of the norm, not part of the pack, the clique, you're already going to be treated unfairly, ostracized, and different things like that. So different cultures and different types of people in this community, especially back in those days, were dealing with this kind of stuff. And some people were just strong enough to not take it anymore, and some people remained quiet and dealt with it. And us as youths back then, with both of our movements coming together, we made noise in the media and we made noise in the street.
Right. Yeah, it's a lot of parallels, you know. And I think, you know, when I think of the term bridge, it's such an interchangeable word, you know, still playing off your book and the concept. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about coming from youth into adulthood and then based on a physical geographic location, you know, and
right.
And then eventually reaching a phase or a stage of adulthood and maturity where you didn't return to that place anymore. And maybe it's because the place was inside of you, you know. And I think about the things that were important to us on the streets as young people and the passion and commitment we had. And I say to people sometimes, you know, being part of the Baldies and anti-racist action and the anti-racist skinhead, you know, we could call it a movement for lack of a better term at that time, where we were actively going out and organizing and fighting against fascism and organized racist. You know, being part of that crew mentality where you were always relying on safety and strength and numbers, it actually taught me how to have confidence by myself later in my adulthood. There are so many things that I learned from being engaged in that allowed me to feel more stable and secure as an adult. So I say all that to say, when you think about the times that we were discussing in the 80s and 90s, our reference point was always the Black Power movement, the Civil Rights movement in the 60s. And now, you know, it's 2019, Ryan. So reflecting on what we went through, what you went through, then what do you see as the parallels now in this generation, this era, and where do you see us going when you look forward?
That's really a tough question, and I'm going to tell you why. Because in our era, the way we grew up was different. We weren't exposed to a lot of crazy things, video-wise, visually, that we're exposed to now. We, you know, there are a lot of us that were born before crack cocaine was even around, so we've seen the way things change. You know, the OJ trial changed a whole lot of things back in the early 90s, you know, because you're continuously seeing a person getting kicked and timed in the head, beat so much that you get immune to watching the violence.
Oh, you're talking about Rodney King, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. To where you have, you know, world star hip hop, to where you have YouTube and different things, to where you're seeing all this violence go down. And the all the things that go with it. It's just this, and I'm not saying this in a bad way, but I'm just saying that the people, a lot of young people that were born under a certain age or time or year, have a different take on what they see and what they're immune to more so than people like us that might have had to conform to constantly seeing certain things on TV.
Wow.
Or your community transformed into something else where you're not really, you still can't believe it, but it's too late.
Mm.
You know what I mean? I have 6 children, 7 grandchildren, and they all think differently. They all have different mind states. You know, you look at your child and you say, hey, I want this child to be just like me. They will, but in the era of communication that they understand.
Right.
It's the new you. So these kids today, there's no way I can determine where it's going. I just hope that some of the visuals and things that are said or the influences that are easily pushed are allowed to be exposed for what it is at times.
Mm.
You know, like as far as like intake or mental outlook because of what somebody else says or something like that. We went through the same thing. And that's why I said I can't really determine it, because when the NWA came out, it transformed thousands of kids.
Right.
Into gangsters or hustlers, or, you know, their mentality changed, and now they're calling girls by different names and different things like that. So, you know, for people of our generation to determine where the next generation is just one of the hardest things you could ever do.
Yeah.
But I just know that in some form or fashion, as long as the culture can keep going, and some of these atrocities are politically, like, are exposed, you know, as far as the disrespect to minorities, because it's not just a Black thing, man, it's a Latino thing too.
Right, right.
I hate to see that, you know, because growing up and even just the influence of hip-hop, it's always been like somebody Spanish in the middle of it that's dope. Like one of my best friends, my older OG homie from KGB, KP member, name is Ray.
Ray.
He's Puerto Rican brother, LBS, Latin Bomb Squad. He's one of the best writers I know, man.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a slick guy that was keeping the movement going.
You talking about Ray? You know what I mean? Matt, Ricky's brother.
Yeah, Ricky's brother.
Yeah, they're actually Chicano, man. I remember I used to accidentally refer to Ray as Puerto Rican, right? You know, mm-hmm. Because the community we had a lot of native cats, we had Puerto Rican cats, we had Chicano cats, and
right.
people actually had their pride and identity, you know, but sometimes we would make assumptions, you know, because I was used to thinking about hip hop, the brown presence in hip hop as predominantly Puerto Rican, right? But Ray was always quick to be like, man, I'm not Puerto Rican, I'm Mexican, you know, even though there was solidarity amongst all of us. Yeah, man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, nah, it's just, you know, when you look at it from the standpoint of where I'm looking at it, even back then to now, it's a youthful thing.
Right.
People make it racial at the end of the day, but all the kids, you know, want to do, and what I still want to do is just represent and express myself in whatever way I do without anybody trying to judge me.
That's what's up, man. Hey, we got to run, actually, to the listeners. You've been listening to Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw. My guest today has been DJ Stage One, a.k.a. Ryan Dillard. And one more time for the people, if the people want to pick up a copy of the book, where can they reach out to you at?
DJ Stage One at gmail.com, DJSTAGEONE at gmail.com.
Hey, brother, I'm going to follow up. It's been good talking to you, and thank you for joining us on KBOO.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right, fam. Peace.
All right. Peace.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society Concert Series, featuring artists touring nationally and internationally. Shows start this September with Jim Queskin and Meredith Axelrod. The new season continues with artists Bill Staines, Radim Zenkel, and the Honey Whiskey Trio. Then 2020 kicks off with Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor, followed by Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, Robin and Linda Williams,